So I wanted to show you a couple of blogs that are out here. So if you're not reading, when you're not reading FMH, you might be reading Steph Modo, who talks about presenting seasonal fruit in a simple way. So this is a Mormon blogger who lives in Seattle, who, I mean, this is her, this is how she presents food. One of my favorites to serve family and friends is a simple unadulterated fruit salad. Like, if I serve that to my kids, I think they would think it was, I mean, it's beautiful, but I don't think they would know what to do with it.
I do that every night, Sheila.
You do? So this girl is in my ward, and she has a food blog that she's been able to quit her real job and do blog and take pictures, and you can see that her blog is beautiful, her food is beautiful. And I've actually made quite a few of her things, and everything's been pretty good that I've made, too. But just another example of kind of maternal culture. This is my college roommate. And she writes, my son requested a 3D Yoda Star Wars cake for his 5th birthday.
My gosh.
And this is what she comes up with.
You can't talk to me.
What?
Oh, you see that?
Wow.
Fuck no.
Yes, you would.
And Amber, I know you, Amber cakes.
Make a cake or two.
Yeah. That are awesome. Okay.
Yeah. She talks in her blog about how she made it. It's fascinating.
Yeah.
She's an artist.
She is an artist.
She's a true like a real artist.
She gets on the blog and she's like, oh, you can do this too. And I'm like, there is no way in 1,000 years that I could roll a Yoda out of one. Like, she...
be fair, everything she touches is gold. When I read her blog, that's how I feel. She's like one of those women that you want to hate, but she's too nice to
you. Yeah.
Just for fun, it's funny when I saw that because my ex made a Yoda cake for my son, too.
And did it look
good? It was just the head. So it didn't have the body, but it looked good.
Pretty awesome. I probably don't have enough time left. All right, how are we doing?
You have 2 minutes.
Okay. Well, one of the things I was going to... So other things that we have posted about in the past are, like, the sort of foodie. Like, so it seems like you can kind of go the foodie venue or the not foodie venue. And Artemis has had several posts about lots of posts about fancy chocolate foods. Her Valentine post about chocolate souffle cake this year. There's been an ongoing discussion at FMH about Poolish from Sarah and Artemis have kind of talked about it.
A bread baking.
Yeah. And then I feel like I love to bake, but often I find myself more in this camp where Lisa posts the exhaustive list of edible food according to Buttercup, who is 5. And this is like how I feel like I'm hemmed in with having 4 kids, 11 and under, that we eat a lot of dang quesadillas at my house. And then I think Mormon food also goes into food storage feminist style. And then this idea of eating meat sparingly, which we, which is kind of a religious idea too. Final thoughts on food and maternal culture from you guys, anything?
If anybody wants some of those canned items you saw in that picture, they will be door prizes tonight at the Blogger Knuckle get together.
She makes it her mean canned green beans. So.
Tomorrow night. Friday night. Sorry.
So it seems like a lot of this is Mormon food is performed communally, whether it is going down to the, packing the cannery and packing up cans. Or whether it is bringing dishes to somebody after they have a baby, or whether it is funeral potatoes. It seems like what you're saying is a lot of these are communal events.
Yeah, and even the things that take place in our homes, through blogging, I think a lot of times those become communal events because we show them off. When they're awesome, we're going to show them off to people. Yeah.
My comment is that they have to be certain kinds of food.
Okay.
I live in a rural Southern Utah small town, and I'd had a playful conversation with my husband about a month before he suddenly passed away, and we were actually planning his funeral. Oh, yeah? What kind of bread do you want on the roast beef deli sandwiches? Oh, ciabatta. And so I actually felt quite committed to carry out his dying wishes. And as I was going from the memorial into the kitchen, I heard the women in the kitchen saying how she thinks she's too good for human. And I have to say, it was one of my best. You know how you think of things to say after? I went in like this, and I went with my arms around both of them. I said, "Would it be possible to just lay this to rest right now?" All the color grayed out of their faces. You know, Brent, the other sculpture teacher, and when you were my ceramic student,
yes.
I married him, and we were married for 10 years. I married my teacher. Yeah, I was talking to you. But that was just a big. It was a lesson to me about how ingrained we are in our food practices. You know, it's not just kind of lemonade.
Yeah, and my mother-in-law had the same conversation that she worked at a wedding this weekend, and how they didn't do, or a funeral, and they didn't do what she thought they were going to do with the whole release.
Was she mad, or was she on the other side of the team?
She's kind of annoyed, but yeah.
I think it's because we get into these ruts, and it becomes almost a pseudo-sin to do anything else. And when I was called to be the activity chairperson before they outsourced that job, I was required to write my goals for the activities committee for the year as part of our thing, and my bishop was really so. I wrote, I said, "We will not serve ham or field potatoes or jello at any event. We will not, like, all of my things. We can eat good food and still put it within the budget and be fine." And the first couple of activities we had, there was a lot of pushback. There was a lot, and I said, "This is my calling, and if I was inspired to receive this calling, then I'm inspired to receive inspiration for this calling."
Uh-huh.
I've since left the church. But I was, as a ward activity chairperson, in charge of, I was on the committee for the steak pioneer breakfast, and I was put in charge of the ham for the steak pioneer breakfast, which is culturally against my religion to serve ham for breakfast. But anyway, so I'm like, okay, well, how much ham do I have to buy? And they told me, you know, buy, it was like 120 pounds of ham, have it warmed up and ready to serve and slice by 7 a.m. in the park where there's no electricity to keep it warm. And so I did that, and I just went and bought spiral sliced ham and cut it up and served. And they loved it. And the state president gave me that job for 2 years in a row after that because it was real food. And well, and then this year, I got no less than 5 phone calls regarding what kind of ham they should buy, how many warmers they should, because they decided that they didn't need the sliced pre-formed turkey ham anymore, and the state president won't accept any less. So we upped the, and I think you can up the, you can up the quality of the food, even in the large ship that is the Mormon food.
Yeah, I didn't get any pushback.
Okay, thank you so much. We are gonna move to, who's next, Lisa?
Let's do Lindsay.
Okay.
Should I stand up? Okay, so I introduced myself, and I introduced myself for those who were here to hear that. I run a little preschool out of my house. And we were just talking earlier that I, before I taught preschool out of my home, I was the arts coordinator for a school district. And it was like this big glory job, you know, planning all these big, huge events. And then I decided to start a preschool when I wanted to stay home. And I've kind of gotten an interesting look at how people view that. I often hear, "Oh, you started a little preschool or a little daycare in your home. Good for you." You know, and so I want to talk today about how the businesses that stay-at-home parents are doing, and how there's this idea in our church culture and in our culture at large that women can't and shouldn't have it all. You know, there's kickback with that. There's always this debate of being the stay-at-home mom within the church or the working mom. And I think both are absolutely valid choices. But for me, my choice was to stay at home and work. That was just how I grew up. I'm a busybody. Everyone that knows me knows that. In fact, I brought this craft that I got kind of ironically. Like, I have this in my house. I think it's ironic. Do you guys see this? Do you ever see Simplify in people's homes in vinyl and their home is, like, decked out? I just think it's so funny. I love it. So, anyway, what I was doing is I was walking around my neighborhood and we get these little cards everywhere. I don't know if any of you that live in the corridor get invited to Pamper Chef parties and slumber parties and I don't know, candle parties. There's so many. I came up with a short list. Scentsy. Yeah, exactly. What other businesses have you seen that women are doing from home?
Essential oils.
Melaleuca.
There's these new rag cleaning things.
Oh, yeah.
I've gotten like five invitations in the last 2 weeks for those.
The jeans. Yeah, I brought a prop because if you are in Stansbury Park and you want to look like everybody else, you can wear, we call them your glam your glutes jeans, the blinged out butts. I kid you not, and I'm not exaggerating, pretty much every woman in my ward, if you're at like a Walmart on a Friday night, we're all sparkling as we're walking down the aisles. Because they've been having these LA Idol parties.
Lindsay, and did you bring some to sell?
And you can have some for only. No, anyway, so I just think that's kind of funny that, like, how this culture is, and we kind of make fun of it and we kind of tease about it. But I've been trying to think of the value of it. And Lisa and I were talking before, what gives something value? What gives something value? And often, value is related to something that makes money. You know, if I can make money from it, then it's valuable. But if I don't make money from it, then it's not valuable. And on the flip side of that, I make money from my preschool. It's actually pretty lucrative if you're a stay-at-home parent and you have the space and you don't have all this overhead. It's a good job. So that should give it value, right? To me it does. That's part of the value, but I want to kind of talk about the other things that people are doing. So we talked about some of the list. I wanted to talk about this sort of revival of cottage industries, and anyone that's not familiar with that term, cottage industries, before the Industrial Revolution, people would farm, and then during the off-season, the wintertime, they didn't have a way to make money, so they would figure out a way to make money from the home. So they would put their kids to work weaving or carding or sewing or whatever to make money. And then when you had the Industrial Revolution come, you have people physically leaving the home to go to a workplace. And we see that kind of in Mormon culture. I was reading Spencer W. Kimball's, Two Mothers in Zion pamphlet. You guys all read that? That's the one where...
Ezra Taft Benson.
Thank you. Ezra Taft Benson, and he said, contrary to conventional wisdom, a mother's calling is in the home, not in the marketplace. That Adam is supposed to earn, bread by the sweat of his brow, right? And it's not supposed to be a woman. And so I think that we kind of grew up, at least I grew up in that culture, the man goes to work and the woman stays home. And growing up, that's just what I always planned I was going to do. And I think that there's value in that. And I don't want to demean that, and I don't want to demean a woman that pursues a career. I think both are valid and both have value. But I grew up in a home where my mom taught preschool. It was a family business. And I remember she taught preschool in her basement, and my room was right next door to the preschool room. And I would wake up sometimes if I was sick from school to the sound of children, laughter. It just kind of became the sound of home for me, having children playing. And even if my mom was sick, I was able to substitute for her to stay home from school. It was our family business. It wasn't just my mom's business. And we would sit around the dinner table, and we would talk about how do we implement this activity? What's the proper way to dye an Easter egg? You know, and as we're doing that, we're helping my mom, but all of us kids were learning from it. And so I ended up going into education. My sister's a third grade teacher. My other sister's a fifth grade teacher, and my brother started his own business. And I can directly draw some lines to my mom working from within the home because we learned those things. It was our own cottage industry. It was our own family business. And so I've kind of try to weigh the benefits and the negatives, because there are negatives of working from your home. You have no retirement plan unless you're saving for it yourself. You don't have insurance. You never get to leave work home. You don't always have adult interaction. I have adult interaction with parents, which isn't always a good thing, but it's adult interaction. But there's just some funny cultural things that I wanted to talk about that I see happening in the corridor. I like to call it cottage sin-dustries. You guys heard of these slumber parties, these pleasure parties? I love this. Okay, if you're not familiar, you get together, you get this little invitation, and you go meet with other women, and they sell adult toys and lingerie and sex advice with your neighbors.
Have you been to one?
Okay, I've been.
Like, are you perceived?
I've been invited, but I haven't gone. I should give that as a disclaimer. But and we've had several, like, there's rumors of bishops like shutting them down, you know. But I've seen truly women empowered by the fact that, like, a Relief Society president gets to go and talk about her sexuality with her neighbors. So, there's some value in these weird things. And we were talking earlier about how some of these businesses are kind of predatory. They prey upon women's gifts, their time, and probably their desire to contribute something. And so I just want to open it up to you. What sort of businesses do you see happening from stay-at-home parents, and do you think that they're valued, and what gives them value, if at all? That's kind of a complicated question.
I feel like I've already talked a lot, but I have a business at home. I make and sell fancy cakes. I do wedding cakes and birthday cakes and stuff like that. And I often get the comment of, that's too much money. They think because I'm doing it at home, because I'm doing it at home and I want to charge them $200 for a three-tier wedding cake that'll feed 150 people, that's too much money because I don't have an actual business. Mm-hmm. And so my time and my talents are not valued as much because I am doing it at home. Now, I pay taxes and I have a license and there's an actual cottage business license that you get if you're doing it from home that most of the other businesses don't have, but because I don't have a brick and mortar store, it's not valued as much. And I see it with my friends who are photographers. I see it with my friends who cut hair. The moment you're doing it from your home, it's not as valuable. Its value decreases in the eyes of people. Even if, like, my friend is a super talented haircutter stylist, I don't know the actual term, but because she does it from home, she feels like she can only charge a quarter of what she would charge in a salon. So the location sometimes in people's eyes, your time
affects
is
the legitimacy
not
of. Anyone else have any experiences with that?
Yeah, let's see. What I was going to say was just what you were talking about, the cottage industry and coming out of, you know, the Industrial Revolution. I don't know if everybody's read A Midwife's Tale, Laurel Fletcher Ulrich, where she took the actual diary of a midwife in early 1800s New England.
So it was like the 1600s, I think. It was really early.
Yeah, you're right. What am I saying?
It was pre-Revolutionary War. Was it?
It was
pre-Revolutionary
War?
No, it wasn't.
Puritan times, wasn't it?
It was post. It was shortly post-Revolutionary.
Yeah. Right. Because she knew someone who had been present. Okay. So my partner Jason and I, we were reading it out loud in bed, and it totally revolutionized my life because it had never occurred to him. She talks a lot in it about how she's a working woman. She's a midwife. But, I mean, she's go, go, go. Like, you know, fording streams and rivers to get, you know, miles away and deliver these babies. She can't do housework by herself. And as her daughters age and, you know, marry off and are apprenticed out to other places, she needs someone to do housework and to take care of this, like, domestic sphere because she is working. And so as we're reading that portion of it where she's talking about, you know, bringing neighbor girls in and trading, like she'll teach them weaving and in exchange they'll like clean her home and everything, I just want to say that's how I got a cleaning service. But like until my husband read that and saw that, like, I think he just, you know, both of us kind of cling to this idea of like we should be responsible, we shouldn't be modern and dilettantish, but that there's something that we whitewash history so that women have always taken care of this sphere and that it's just not true. It's a very, you know, anesthetized version.
We've got a few. Did you
you're going to come on turns, right?
Yeah,
go with that one first.
I mean, there's been some studies, of course, and we've written about the marketing of, I mean, there was a deliberate marketing campaign by manufacturing companies a century ago to get people onto goods. And the message was, you know, the bread that your mom bakes at home is not as good as the stuff that our snazzy company makes.
Formula, too.
Yeah, baby veal.
Oh, that's a terrible.
And so this ends up with a cultural devaluation, and so you end up with somebody saying, well, a wedding cake made at home isn't as good as the wedding cake that you would get at wedding cakes.
Yeah.
In and but recently, you know, a little bit of a shift as you know, for, eBay and then Etsy have allowed for the marketing and sale of cottage produced items.
But it's like either way, we can't get away from the dogma of it. Either it is you suck because you're not making your own bread, or you suck because you're making your own bread. Like, I mean, it seems like there's so little play between the two of respecting that. You're probably still a whole woman and partner if you do make your own bread. If you don't, you know, that like that it's such a signifier for what camp you're in.
Well, and I know that when I was talking to a lot of women in my ward about this, and when I was telling them my presentation, what it was on, some of them got defensive, one in particular, and I think what she was defensive about is she is a stay-at-home mom, she doesn't bring in any income, and she was worried that I was challenging what she was doing, that by me working was saying what you're doing is not good enough. But like Sarah said, it's right. There is a trade-off here. It's not for everyone, and my husband can tell you this. I am not the best homemaker. I can cook. I like to cook. I rarely cook very often. We eat a lot of convenience food. That's the trade-off. And sometimes you have to weigh that. If your priorities are having your kids have these really, like, you're going to grind your own wheat, that's valuable and that's valid. I don't do that. I put my efforts into something else, and that's what it is. And do I wish that I could do all these other things? Yes. So with this idea of women having it all, I really like playing around with it. I think, you know, back in the 70s, when Benson, is that who I keep quoting?
Ezra Taft Benson.
Ezra Taft Benson said these comics. Thank you. We didn't have the internet. I mean, you could have a cosmetology party or cosmetology or Tupperware party and reach just a few women in your area, like maybe 10 streets at best. But now you have the internet. You have Etsy, which is, you know, like a crafter's eBay where you can sell your stuff. And it's not perfect. It's flawed, but it's making Mormon women go global. And then it's empowering for these women. I know a woman that she started doing her daughter's hair, and she was into it. She just wanted to do it really crafty and clever. And so she developed this, like, string, and if you tied a knot into it, you could wrap it all cool. And she ended up starting a business called Knotheads. I don't know if anyone's heard of it. And she now her stuff is going in the Emmy bags at the Emmys, and she's just doing it out of her home. And it started from doing her daughter's hair. And so what I'm trying to ask all of you is working from home, is there value in working from home? Are these businesses good for women? I think that they are, just from my own personal experience. But am I out of time?
Yes.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Actually, well, I got to go back on one of your other comments real quick. When you were talking about like the sex toy parties that uh-huh. women are throwing, my ex, she threw one of those parties. I'm just telling you from my feedback what I got, because she told me, and she was really excited about it. She was like, oh, no. And from my personal point of view, I thought it was really good for her, because she instead of it being a degraded, like, women have had a very bad rap as far as sex goes, it was liberating for her. I could hear it in her voice that she could be talk with other people and be proud of her sexuality. That part I thought was very good, and I think that needs to. I'm
seeing that happen a lot. I mean, Pampered Chef, I used to look down because I would get invited. It became this like horrific obligation. Like, seriously, every week, it was a pain. But I think women often feel guilty when they're not bringing value to the table or when they're not doing something. And so it provides a way for women to get emotional support and strength while they feel like they're doing something. Now, should that happen? I don't know. But that's the framework that we're working in as LDS women.
There's some serious predation that happens in that context. And you see these ubiquitous ads that, you know, housewife works 10 hours a week, earns $1,000 a month. Mm-hmm. And all, I mean, the Washington Post has an article about how some of these are kind of scams. And there are a lot of business models that
don't actually work and are designed to extract money from housewives who want to bring in money and transfer their money to the participants, to the planners of the events. So it's it's difficult.
And Lindsay and I were talking about this beforehand, but like the unspoken conceit that you know, the fulcrum that rests on is you aren't doing anything anyway, and you know, women's time is valueless, so you might as well be making some money.
Right, yeah, because we really want to buy into TV all day. Huh? You know, this perpetuation of materialism and consumer society.
It's a very I asked this question because Lisa brought this up too, and it's like kind of almost this American consumerist thing. Like, I need to. It's only valuable if I'm making money, and look, I'm making money. I'm bringing money in. I'm getting all this stuff. Or you know what I'm saying? Like, I'm going to go socialize with these women at the Scentsy party, and it's going to be valuable because I'm buying something for my family. And it's that idea of buying something for my family is valuable rather than my time. And I think that is a problem, definitely a problem in the church and our culture, but I think that this is kind of women's answer for that in a way.
And I think the blogging monetization or not monetization kind of plays into that too.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, we haven't monetized, but I mean, I showed my neighbor as an example of, you know, with her food blog, and she's been able to quit her job, and that's her profession, and
design
it's her profession
mom?
Instead of her hobby.
Design mom.
Yeah.
Oops,
yeah.
They're millionaires.
Sorry.
Oh, you said something about buying it, and that's because that gets factored into growth, that wonderful magic word.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say something that that from Lisa's other comment in the other panel that I think works into this. I think the most important thing that you guys are cultivating through the internet and also as just groups of women is the knowledge that you have, that you're sharing, that you're strengthening your communities. You know, it's bad when you can't read your own writing. So, you know, and I was thinking about how many times I've been inspired by the women in this particular the FMH community by something that I read. And then I've gone out and learned how to do that thing, right? I think we've all been. And I think that's the most important thing, that we have, like, knowledge to share with each other and then with the larger community at large. I think that's, like...
That is the perfect lead-in to Nikki.
Perfect segue. Thank you, Mel. Now, on my drive from Idaho this morning, I had this paradigm shift, so... Everything is, like, scratched out and rearranged, so bear with me a little bit here. But I have a question for you to think about as we're talking, and it might not seem like it's going to be relevant, but I'll bring it back. But the question I have for you is that voice in your head that tells you what to do when, you know, when things go dark and there's crisis, is that voice gendered? Do you hear it as yourself? Do you hear it as the Holy Ghost, your conscience, your mother, Jiminy Cricket? No. What's that voice?
You bet it's gender. You bet it is.
Okay.
One comment. Okay. Well, the Bible, if you go back through history, generally is always written by men. And their, frankly, their view of God, too. And so... The way they put it, I mean, man, it's got to be gendered. It's just my opinion.
Okay, I'll be interested to hear from the women.
It's God's voice. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that there might be a male dominant jerk that's saying this isn't the way it's supposed to be.
It's my mom's voice.
For sure.
Okay. For sure. For sure.
Okay. I think my voice is feminine.
So
I think my inner voice is a woman that talks to me.
I think it's situational.
Okay.
Shooting a gun, it's my dad's voice. Baking a cake, it's my mom's.
Right.
Okay. So maybe related to who taught you to do what. All right. It has been argued that in the LDS church, men tell women how to be women. Men preach a particular role for women, tell them how they should dress, and supervise and approve their activities in church auxiliaries. We've been talking today about some traditionally feminine activities that contribute to Mormon material culture. And I submit that for women, and maybe for men, the matriarchal transmission of both internal and external culture, so teaching our morals and teaching
these feminine activities, traditionally feminine activities, is a reaction to and an antidote to the outward and maybe inward, depending on the gender of the voice in your head, male voice that dictates what good women believe and what good women do. Kind of an example of this, it's recently my building, my church building, which was built in the 50s, was remodeled and the stage was taken out and replaced with classrooms. And I've thought about that quite a bit, what that says about us as a people. And there's been some lament about, you know, road shows and that we don't do those kinds of things. And so I was thinking about that form of self and communal expression that's lost when the stage is gone. And then that leaves us when we get up in front of our peers, either to be at the pulpit or in a teaching position or in leadership, all of which is more of a patriarchal structure than a communal structure, kind of going off what Lisa was saying about the traditional versus the, was it invitational structure you're talking about? That let me tell you what I have to say, instead of let's hear what you have to say and then I'll tell you what I have to say. The subject of traditionally feminine craft within Mormonism is rife with paradox. Janet Girard Willis, who also blogs at Feminist Mormon Housewives, likes to speak of the subversive nature of what is considered womanly craft. She posits the interesting idea that crafts are a kind of language that men, and as she puts it, uppity women, can't read. So the idea of feminine crafts position as being kind of opposite in status to something like high art or industrial production, and it has associations with leisure, time-consuming, repetitive activities, detailed and often decorative handwork, is habitually undertaken by amateurs, generally women, in the domestic arena or collectively at sewing groups or neighborhood quilting bees, and has conventionally marked it out as low-status women's work. The work of the hand rather than the intellect, and therefore worthy of less attention. On the other hand, this outsider position that craft takes as being opposed to something like high art, the fact that craft has historically been located in the home or village halls, local cafes, church groups, that is at the heart of family and community life rather than official spaces of museums and galleries makes it appropriate for imagining new ways of living, social relationships and identities, and forging transformative possibilities for connecting community through creativity. And I'm thinking of like what Melanie was saying, rather than consuming, we can get an idea of things that you can do for yourself, repurposing things, sharing knowledge that already exists. One of the things that I like to think about is that, of course, within Mormonism, these traditionally feminine arts have a much more elevated status. Women who enjoy and excel at them are highly visible and often sought out to teach lessons and Super Saturday classes. The way that we transmit the knowledge of these various traditionally feminine activities among women in general, and Mormons in particular, and I don't know if it's because we are cheap, you know, we're thrifty, we decommodify the transmission process, meaning we don't pay to take a class. We share the knowledge that already exists. And while this transmission sometimes follows hierarchical and usually matriarchal lines, we usually take a more democratic approach by teaching each other and building social capital through engagement with ideas, processes, and practices of creating and making. And one of the things I was thinking about is the Ward Cookbook. And what kind of a Mormon material artifact and Mormon maternal artifact that is.
Can I comment
on
that?
Yeah, do it.
So my sister-in-law, I was at her house in Alaska a couple weeks ago, and she had out her ward cookbook that was her mom's, from her mom's ward. And her mom had given it to her when she got married and written it beside each person's name. Yes, no, yes, maybe. Like, whether or not you could trust this person's food as food that you would want to make.
Okay.
I use my homework. It's my homework cookbook that I have. My mom gave each of the kids one, and I only use it as a reference for my mom's recipes because I know what they taste like. Oh, and one other spud nuts. She was
yes. Well, oftentimes you know the authors of all of these recipes. You may have even had their food at a potluck or when you had a baby. And if you have a question, you can call it. Yeah, go ahead.
It also becomes an arena for Mormon women to show and perform their authentic Mormon womanness by submitting a really good recipe and for everyone to say, like, wow, yeah, yes. Nikki's recipe is great, and, you know, this other one is not, and boy, you know, don't make that one. And so, it becomes this complicated competition in authentic performance of Mormon feminine identity.
Well, I think that at least I've seen that you can draw like a direct correlation between someone's like status as a Mormon in the ward with their ability to like execute a craft or a centerpiece properly.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. One of the ways I was thinking of that we decommodify this process, and Mel alluded to this, is that we teach each other to do things. For example, Artemis has taught my 8-year-old daughter how to knit. She has now knitted 2 scarves. She can cast on by herself. It's a complete mystery to me, you know, how it's done. But she loves to do it. And I have, one of the things that I love to do is quilting. And my grandmother was a quilter. And even though that process wasn't transmitted to me through her, and my mother also died when I was young, so that there was sort of this broken chain. But another woman taught me how to quilt. And since then, I've taught others how to do it as well. Lisa gives free yoga classes. Sarah teaches bread making. So one of the ideas that I like about that is that the act of sharing the knowledge also tends to increase the pleasure. And we talked about value. Increases the value of this activity also for both the teacher and the learner. And I don't know, is this an even though or in spite of no money changing hands? Does that make it more pleasurable? Or is it an in spite of that? What do you think?
It makes it more valuable.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it was, but because of the way we do it, I mean, I think it's empowering because it's a genuine, egalitarian, communal sharing of skills. With those other examples, like Etsy, or not necessarily Etsy, but like certainly like Scentsy or pyramid marketing schemes, someone else is actively capitalizing on my labor. In this model, we're all equally capitalizing on our shared, you know, pooled. We're living the United Order.
I've also noticed a large exchange of more of a bartering system between people. Like, I bartered for family pictures. I made her a super, super fancy birthday cake for a kid. I barter for massages on a regular basis. And I trade my goods and services, and I almost feel like they're worth more when I'm trading for a service than when I get paid and my accountant husband goes through and goes, you made $7.50 an hour when you made this thing that took about 3.5 days or something.
I have a girlfriend who has a button maker, so the FMH buttons that we have on the registration table, which you all should get, I said, well, I can pay you for these, and then I'll just donate them to FMH through that. And she said, oh, I didn't get any dill pickles last year. Like, if you kick down dill pickles for me, you can have the button maker and the goods. And I thought, that totally works.
Well, and what about, like I don't quilt, but I look at her quilts. I don't know if you've seen Nikki's quilts. She does. I think of, like, if you were to break down hourly, if you paid, like, $200 for a quilt, and you were to break that down hourly, how much she would get for that? Does that make it valuable? It's awful. Like, the work that we put into something, money doesn't necessarily make it so. And even coming here, I picked up my husband, and I was telling someone that he works with where I was going, and he said, is that a paying gig? You know, you're making money? And I think that's what people think. You're wasting your time if you're not making some money from it.
When I first started working as an editor, my husband was like, well, how much does that pay? I'm like, nothing. It's just
for the love of editing.
Yeah. I think it creates community cachet in a sense. I mean, both in the work context, mm-hmm. you know, you're known as somebody who can do some work.
Yeah.
You come to Sunstone and you're the person who gives presentations and people like your presentations. So it's a different type of value received. And there's reciprocity. Like, you know, you want somebody to give you, they want your dill pickles and they want them to.
It's not a metaphor. They actually want my
dumplings. But you're able to. But I think you need a certain level of financial security to be able to enjoy doing those things.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. But when I had a bread business that was not out of my own home, you know, I mean, I had a commercial retail space, I did work out what my dollar per hour was, and it was really depressing. But I could say on the other side of the ledger what I was gaining. There was nobody else who was capitalizing off of me, which I think is a psychological and a, you know, business lucrative way of assessing, you know, what you're doing. It is somebody else capitalizing off of my labor. And so, I mean, at least it was me who was a slave driver to myself.
Well, I just wanted to say, I know, like, I went through this phase where I scrapbooked for, like, 5 years. And I think... when you said that someone asked you if it was a paying gig, I remember, like, mostly it would be the males. It would be the men in my life. Be like, mm-hmm. oh, so how are you going to make, you know, they would be asking if I'm making money doing it. And I think as women, we appreciate things more for the art or the craft of it, or the enjoyment of it. And it's men that seem to be the ones that want us to be doing something productive and making money off of it or something.
Well, and that you'd even phrase it that we're making something, we're doing something productive.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's that's a certain point of view, like, what is productivity? You know, and there's a sort of, like, you know, how do we define that? If we make something that beautifies our lives and makes the people around us happy, is that not productive? You know, like, is the quality of life that we create by creation, is that not productive? You know, like,
yeah,
can
like
we not value that?
If you put all this work into a piece of paper, why would you do that? You know, people don't understand. Like, I love scrapbooking, too. It's an art form expression. I get a lot out of it. But it's like, why did you put all that time into that? You know, why is that? I think it's the same thing. I think, what is productive? I feel productive when I've done a scrapbook page. Yes! Done the history. Done. Some people are like, that's a waste of time. You glue it in your book, you know? Sorry.
Yeah. Okay. One last idea that maybe we can talk about for a minute. Let me just skip that, and I want to go back to the idea of this feminine voice. That these free-flowing and often reciprocal instruction is the backbone of the Relief Society meeting, formerly known as homemaking and then as home, family, personal enrichment. We could argue that these meetings at once confirm and then subvert the correlated male voice that tells women that their participation in these meetings are an outgrowth of their natural inclination towards nurturance and homemaking. So it confirms that because patriarchy has been successful in claiming these domestic values for women and using it as a way to keep women in subservient roles, but subversive because men's voices are checked at the door. There's women there, and the feminine voice becomes authoritative. On the other hand, one of the things I was thinking about when I was coming down is one of the students that I had, I'm a 4-H leader and I teach quilting, was a 11-year-old boy, and his quilt won first prize of all the quilts entered. And I hope it wasn't because he was the boy, but What I think, because his quilt was very strikingly male in the patterns that he chose, it was red and black and gold. It was very striking. And so within this traditionally feminine framework, he created something that was masculine and really pleasing and kind of refreshing. And so it makes me uncomfortable to assign masculine and feminine to this. And as the mother of a son myself, also 5 daughters, I want my son, who really enjoyed making a doll quilt for his sisters for Christmas and making an apron for another one of his sisters. He loves that machine. He thinks it's all kinds of fun. I want him to be able to claim that for himself as well, and which is why I'm uncomfortable with the whole masculine-feminine thing. And that, so I don't know what to do with that,
And I don't know that we have time to explore that, but it's definitely something that I think about.
Amen.
That might segue into yours, Derek.
I was going to say, my actually, it just is, it does kind of relate to both of them, whereas Nikki was talking about the traditionally feminine skills and characteristics, and where Lindsay was talking about the woman moving into what is traditionally men's roles, commerce, and commodifying those skills that Nikki was talking about. And I say that I know commodify tends to have a negative connotation, but I think, you know, just in a neutral way, it's kind of what she was talking about, the commodification of their skills. Mine's kind of the reverse of that, being a man who is currently the stay-at-home parent and taking on some of the nurturing care, skills and roles. Now, I joked at the beginning about how I have the least experience of anyone here in the nurturing, though I don't know if that's strictly true. I've always been kind of a nurturing sort of person, even though this is our first child. Growing up, I babysat for years. You know, I just always loved being with the kids, playing with the kids. Up through high school, long after most of my peers switched in to the fast food jobs or whatever that were paid a little more, I just kept babysitting. I really enjoyed it, and I was kind of the ward babysitter for quite a while. Most people would call me for their stuff, and I learned very quickly I had to kind of keep that quiet, be a little discreet about what I was doing with my peers, because that's not what guys are supposed to do. But nevertheless, and that's followed me throughout my life. I've always been, you know, as several people here with kids know, I'll just usually gravitate right to the kids and start playing with them. Very fond of that. In the ward, very quickly picked that out, and they've been very, very supportive. The current one I'm in, I actually had a relief society calling for a number of years, being the official homemaking, enrichment, whatever it was at the given time, nursery leader. And so I've always been a nurturing kind of person. And now that we have a child, it just made the most sense for us because my wife, her job having benefits and paying better than mine, and less wanting to have a parent with him, it made the most sense at this point for me to be able to, for me to stay home with him, and my wife to work. And again, I've noticed generally that's gotten a lot of. I've been kind of surprised at how much positive reaction I've got from that. How many people, even people a generation or two older, when I wouldn't have expected, talking out when their husbands staying home with the kids for a few years at some given time. And so in some ways, it seems like the roles have been. We've broken out of the roles. They're no longer there. We've blended them together. You guys think that's the case? Is that, or have we broken down the wall between the masculine and feminine? Or
I think there's a crack in it.
Yeah,
it's not in all families. You know, some families do. Other families are still going by that traditional mold. So.
Well, I always snort when I hear post-feminist. But I even, particularly for women, I was staying with a friend in Boston, and she's from Spain, and English is her second language, and I thought, maybe I'm misunderstanding this as a language barrier, because I was telling her something about FMH and feminism, and she said, you know, in her heavily accented, you know, English, but Sarah, you know, why do we need feminism? I mean, isn't it over? Maybe you didn't grow up in Spain. Like, maybe you grew up on another planet. Like, I realized that I was so used to having the conversation about how do we carry it out that it was hard to go back to the beginning. Like, it's like having a conversation about, you know, quantum mechanics and someone saying, I think we're using a different alphabet. Like, oh, we don't have the same.
Well, I just, in my experience, like I said, I think I live in a really concentrated area of Mormon culture super concentrated, and I think that the idea of a male nurturer scares a lot of women. They're just uncomfortable with it because they're so set in these defined gender roles. Like, men have the huge sex drive, women don't. Men are the big tough guys, women aren't. Men go to work, women don't. And if you think that we're ahead of that, we are so not ahead of that. You need to come out to my neighborhood because it's just not that way. And so it's very threatening to say, wait, a man can nurture? No, I don't know about that.
Because what happens to that conversation, like in Relief Society, that is about, like, ugh, men, they're the worst. You can't leave them alone for a second.
Exactly.
Or there's a really popular meme on the internet right now about men. They can't dress your children and bring them to the hospital when you have a baby. Like, and I've heard it like 8 different places as like a legitimate understood sort of thing. Like, well, that's a man for you.
And then culturally, there was an article last year, I want to say, in the New York Times about Sweden and the shift in Swedish parenting norms as the government has put in place a set of rules mandating paternity leave. And there's something like a quarter of men now are taking a year of paternity leave and engaging in significant child care. This can be done, but it requires the cultural shift. It requires something to do it. It's not going to happen by itself.
Yeah.
I'm going to go ahead and say this, and hopefully not offend anybody. There's also the whole perception of men, if they nurture their children, they're going to molest them.
Yeah.
And the church perpetuates this myth. Men are not allowed to teach primary by themselves. This is now a worldwide general rule. If a man is alone in a room with a group of children, the door has to be open, or there has to be another man in there with, or his wife. It can't be another woman.
It's not just true for people?
No. Men. Yeah. Women can teach by themselves. Oh, okay. Well, that's, maybe that's progressed.
But, well, and I think there's... I think the rule is no one can, but I think a lot of wards ignore the rule when it's for women.
Oh, yeah. We used to have a babysitter that was a male, and I got comments, you know, are you sure you're comfortable? Do you feel safe?
And I had that experience when I was young, when I had younger children. My husband's best friend was a stay-at-home parent, and he was a student and I was a student. And we each had one child, and so we would arrange our schedule specifically so our classes were opposite days. And then on Mondays and Wednesdays, I would watch his kid. Tuesdays and Thursdays, he'd watch mine. And it was beautiful. It was a wonderful situation. They lived 3 doors down, and we got horrific comments from people. Are you sure? And he was a ginormous black man, too, and that might have been part of it, but... He was very scary, apparently. I know.
And I actually wrote a post on that, where I have experienced that, certainly. Especially with people who don't know me as much. I ward recently, I absorbed part of another ward that was split. And when that happened, for a long time I had been the sole nursery leader for homemaking, just because we had a really small ward, it was hard to get guys. Apparently a lot of this new ward complained. They were uncomfortable, and because I was a guy. They didn't know me yet. It wasn't like they had something against me. Just
by virtue of your gender.
Yeah.
So how do we change
personal,
that perception?
But we think you're a molester.
Well, I was going to say before, that the perception is that if men spend time with children, that they will be more likely to molest them. But there have been some studies that show that the more time a father spends nurturing his children, the less likely he is to molest them. Because there's something about that paternal bond where you feel like their father. Whereas if you feel like the person who just came and this, you know, like there is something about building that relationship with your child that makes you not molest them.
It strikes down the other.
Right.
Right.
And those tribal relations, you know, that we know about tribes where women have multiple sex partners, and I can't remember what they are, it's in South America, and each of those men are then responsible for parenting duties, and so that's 3 less men who would violate your child, because they all consider themselves a parental role.
Is that in
Tibet?
Take
care of, say, all 3? Some guy takes care of all 3 of them.
Where they have polyandry and...
All the people she slept with, regardless of whether they're the biological parent.
Are they related to each other, the men? No. Okay, I read an article, similar thing, but it was like on the side of a mountain like that or something, and that woman would marry five brothers. But then the, like, they would be, they were primarily responsible for child care duties.
In this case, she's not married to the multiple men. It's just, they're just, she had several godparents, and that's how you get your choose your godparents.
But it goes back to that insult that every insult that you can give a man that is insulting has to do with being a woman. I mean, I teach preschool, and like if a boy chooses a girl dress to wear, little kids don't care when they're three. Truly, they don't. I mean, I'm the one that's like, he's in high heels. I wonder what his mom would think. You know, it's me. It's not there. But now my six-year-old is starting to say, you know, if you call a boy a girl, he snickers. Like, he knows that that's funny. And at first I think it's because it's odd. You know, it's different. But I think that we start to put that on them, that, you know, these are the boy colors. And these are, I mean, it's a basic feminist gender issues. And I don't know how you can overcome that until we address those.
We did a post, or maybe you did, Derek, about the nurture shock, about, like, we don't talk about race because we don't want to codify racism, but by not talking about race, we absolutely codify racism. And finding that these messages that we don't think that our children have absorbed because we never spoke about it, like, it absolutely does it. And I didn't do this with my
then they
oldest
just
son.
Then they just think it's forbidden.
Right.
Like, instead of thinking you haven't, they won't learn that because I didn't talk about it. They just think, we don't talk about that. That's dirty.
And I think with my oldest son, I spoke about it in very oblique ways. Like, I didn't want to let the cat out of the bag that it was a sexist society. I think the cat's out, you know. And with my youngest, he has gotten some good messages, but... I'm much more specific, and like when his dad said the other day, when he said, he asked his dad, why are you driving the car to here and not mom? And my partner was kidding, and he said, I'm driving because I'm the man, Atticus. And Atticus laughed and said, that, you can't say that. That would be sexist. But then he automatically knew that his dad was kidding.
Oh.
And that, that was progress.
Yes, kid story.
Back to what you were saying, like, how do you get it together? Like, how do we get the male and female together? I have two thoughts on that. And again, I think you have to go back to the beginning when I'll say this, but Adam was a jerk. And blamed Eve. Well, you can't blame. You can't do that. He didn't take responsibility. So you got to go back to the beginning. And if you keep seeing that that was the right thing to do, then you're going to keep doing that. And you got to realize he screwed up there. And you got to realize that Eve also screwed up when she said and blamed it on a serpent. You can't blame it. She made the choice. He made the choice. They both made a choice. So number one, men and women have to stop blaming each other. That is so root core, and I don't mean just in Mormon religion, it's in all religions, because that's the story that we've been told. And it doesn't matter whether it's true or not. That's what we think it is. That's what we say in the beginning. This is how it is. So we keep following the same stupid pattern. We keep blaming each other. Number two, I think we fear getting together, and we don't really realize how much we do, because the power that's there when you actually get together, that's really key to everything. And I fear that even myself. The power of a real man gets with a real woman. I mean, it scares the crap out of me. And if you start to really look at that and realize it, that's what we're afraid of. And then we'll start to get together. But we try to pretend. Like, it's no big deal. Oh, I'm with a woman. I'm with a man. It's no big deal. It's a huge deal. It's the most power you'll ever find.
Interesting perspective. Thanks. Yeah, I think that we do put up a lot of barriers to try to keep it separate. And I think even though, like I say, on one level, it does seem like there's been progress because of, and some of these reactions seem positive, but I have noticed there's still this kind of the undertone of reinforcing the gender roles. And the fact that in just about every instance I've heard, and in our circumstance even, where a man has been the nurturer, It's never, it can't be by choice. It can't be, this is who I grew up. I wanted to grow up to be a stay-at-home dad. You can't do that. It has to be, well, my wife is making more. It just makes more sense right now. She's going to school, so I'm staying for now. It's not, I'm the father. It's for now, for a while, you know. I do it too. Alice?
I wonder, so you have your graphic design business also, and I wonder if that makes it easier for people to accept that you're staying at home because you also do this other thing.
Yes, I think absolutely. That's another thing that most men in this circumstance do. They all have something else they're either doing or working towards doing.
Well, do people pat you on the head and say, that's cute, that's nice?
That I have the design work
done?
No, right? That's what I'm saying. I think that just being home, people think that it's lesser. I mean, mm-hmm. and I know we started preschool because we needed it financially. And I make money, and I'm not going to apologize for that. For that reason, because I trade goods and services in that way. But there is a huge part of me, and my husband knows this, I have this very, everything has to be equal. I do it because I, inside somewhere, being home and staying home isn't good enough. And I know that's so anti-feminist, but that's where it stemmed from. Because being home wasn't enough. I had to add this too. And I think that that's where it comes from. Being home is lesser, no matter what.
Well, and the another... I think that's the thing I'm experiencing, the thing I've noticed, is kind of what proves the lie to the whole, it's not just a mother, we respect mother. You know, the fact that men can't do that, can't be just a nurturer. We have to have those other things, because that shows that we obviously don't evaluate it as much, that it's not considered as important. It's because we have to be looking to do something else as well as men. In our culture.
I also see that with women, though. I also see I stay at home, but I also have a business. I also run a daycare. I also am going to school. I'm also, like, people, and I do it, too. I do it all the time. Like, I stay home with my kids, but especially once all the kids leave for school. Well, now what are you going to do? What is there left to do with your life, you know, during those times of the day? What are you going to do now? Very, very rarely. I mean, I'm thinking in my circle, just my neighborhood, and I can think of maybe three women that their kids are all gone at school and they stay home and clean their house or read or enjoy their lives. I don't know. But most every other woman is either going to work, going to school, you know, doing something lucrative at home.
Well, and I think the transition for, like, what you're going to do when your kids get older, I don't know about... It scares the crap out of me. Like, when they're grown up, like, where, if I've been home for, you know, 25 years.
But you haven't just been home. You've gone to school and you're teaching. Right. I'm just saying that, you know, and I know I'm not saying it's a bad thing either. Yeah. Just saying that I think society is shifting that way, too.
That's evidence, I think, of something Lisa talked about once in a post about fourth wave feminism. The idea that all the benefits or the breakthroughs in feminism have gone one way. They've allowed women to go into the man's world, but it hasn't gone the other direction. So there's still some undervalued things there. So now that we have those blurring, women feel the pressure too to not just be a mom, and then the church, you know, our hierarchy feels they have to reinforce. Well, it's not just a mom, but the messages that come through the culture say otherwise for those reasons.
Perception that childcare is not a skilled position, and it's not like being a brain surgeon or a rocket scientist or something, and that anybody can do this, and therefore it is, you know, it's menial labor in a sense. And I mean, when you said, you know, I didn't take the higher paying jobs, I stayed at the lower paying, babysitting doesn't pay well. For that matter, even jobs which involve a lot of contact with children, such as school teachers, school teachers are not viewed as a particularly skilled position, which is ridiculous.
Well, and nurses, same thing. That's not really, even though they go get a lot of education, that's not considered a very prestigious, skilled. And what's the common thread through all these? They're all based on maternal or feminine skills and.
But see, I see like a conflict because in the church, like, they say, well, exactly, that's what we're trying to teach. The home, the family is the most important thing, right? But somehow along the way, that message is getting, in my mind, blurred or fuzzy, because then they're saying, but it has to be done this way and this way. And I think maybe that's where we go wrong. I don't know. Because I think, you know, there is misogyny in the culture, but also surely in the church. Yet we value the home. So what's the problem? Because the home is the most important thing. Yet we're not getting the message. At least I didn't get the message.
I would love to see a comparison between the young woman's manual and the young men's manual and the things that they talk about and the things that they learn. I mean, just looking at the activity to stay program versus the scouting program, it's just they're totally different goals. The scouts and the young men's are succeed, have a career, here's how you lead, here's how you are good, you know. And the women's role, I mean, my 12-year-old comes home from church. What did you talk about? We talked about getting married and who we should marry. We talked about having kids. We talked about how to have a good house. We talked about how to be a good mom. I'm like, you're 12 years old. Mm-hmm. I want you to talk about how to develop who you are.
That's why I get
not
released from them. This is too radical for us.
And
I actually thought they deserved a life.
Yeah. But I actually looked through the Young Women's Manual once and saw similar thing. It's fascinating how it's also about being supportive. It's all supportive roles there.
But I think that's a testament to the age of the people who are writing the manuals also.
Well, and those manuals are so old.
Yes.
So.
And yet we're still using them.
Whatever that post, I read that post like about changing the manuals. 15
years.
And
yeah.
I think we end at 6, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I just want to bring it all around and maybe return it back to a larger conversation about just as a personal lived experience, as I have been a blogger. You know, I started out and even still now, I sort of buy into the idea that what we do at FMH, because what we have at Feminist Mormon Housewives is a very, you know, kind of like lived experience blog. Like, we don't pontificate about deep intellectual ideas all the time. It happens. You know, there are some posts that are deeply intellectual, but a lot of it also is just lived experiential, And it is looked down upon. I mean, I don't know how else to say it, because the other blogs out there who consider themselves to be more academic or more, and they're almost all male, they want to pat us on the head and say, oh, isn't it cute what they're doing over there talking about poop, or, oh, I can't believe they're doing another sex post, or, you know, like. And a part of me still buys into it, because I am so embedded in the culture. A part of me thinks, well, you know, it's true. What they're doing is, you know, all academic. And, of course, that's more important than what we're doing, which is just talking about our lives as we live them and helping each other improve our lives and, you know, being really honest.
Or our feelings.
Or working through our feelings. You know, helping each other to live quality, full, interesting lives. That's not as important as discussing, you know, Joseph Smith's toe fungus, right?
Recently discovered toe fungus.
And so I just kind of want to talk about a little bit about the way we see this happening and the way we buy into it, and maybe some ways that we could respond to it. Because it happens with cottage industries. Oh, isn't that cute? It happens, you know, with passing these things on. It happens with, you know, everything that women are engaged in gets undervalued, gets devalued.
First of all, I think I got on there once. Not because I only went on there once, because I recently found out about it. I think it's just awesome, because what's happening is they're figuring out that they're not alone. And sometimes what happens is the woman just sits there by themselves and they think that they're the only one thinking this way. And that they're the only way, and that's how it's normally been for quite a few, maybe 100 years or something. And so what's happening is, I think what you're doing is beautiful, because they're waking up faster and saying, wait a minute, I'm not alone. I'm not the only one that thinks this way. And so I just personally think what you're doing is awesome.
So do you think in finding a community of women where we, like, can communicate and find our voices, that
that will bring us, like that will let us feel like what we do is legitimate if we keep telling each other this is a legitimate, I mean, like, what is it that we can do?
I think it does lead to real world action. I mean, I think you can see, like, the recent temple post, the structure of it, that it started...
I just love that you start talking while you're
playing. Oh, I would do this in a business meeting. That just the structure of it, to begin with, that, like, Nat Kelly wrote the post, and she set really clear parameters around it, you know, saying, we will not discuss these things are up for discussion, we will be respectful, anything else will be heavily moderated. So the parameters were very clearly set to begin with. But that it went from a discussion of different people's experiences and lots of shared validation, lots of, I thought I was the only one, but like about 200 comments in, you have that one girl, that's her online moniker, Nicole, saying, you know, actually, I'm going to go talk to my temple president right now. Mm-hmm. I'm going to get in my car, and I'm going to drive to the temple, and I'm going to speak to the temple president about my experience. And all these people saying, come back and tell us. You know, we want to hear, like, what your experience was. And she did. I mean, I think that's, like, the... It's all that... Validating one another's experience is a resting place. But the next step is action. You know, like, that can't... I don't think we fulfill it.
It's really easy when you feel like you're the only one with an issue. It's easy to say, this is my problem. Yeah. But if you recognize that other people are sharing the same experience, then it's easier to say, you know, maybe the problem isn't just me. Maybe there's something that needs to be fixed. And so it's more likely that you're going to do something to change it.
Well, and it even gives you words. Like, I know me, like, I remember, even in conference, like, I've always thought I was kind of feminist, but... I never knew that that was a bad thing until I started talking about it out loud. And then finally I find Feminist Mormon Housewives. And I remember even in conference when there was that incredible women talk, you know, the one. I was the one that this is how it was. Awesome. Yes, they're finally talking about us and how great we are. And then I got on FMH and everyone's like, oh, this is so bad. They have to tell us we're incredible. And I was like, wow, I never thought about that before. And the more I started identifying it, I could see all these problems. Don't tell us that, you know, we have to have a man always telling us that we're validated to be validated. I just didn't know that before. I was so embedded in the culture. And for me, that's what it's done. And since then, it's like, awareness is your first step. How am I going to get that kind of awareness in my ward when it's perpetuated over and over and over again?
But you know, I think it filters through in ways that we don't know. Like, I'm on this fairly conservative message board of mainstream Mormon women, and that post was referenced. And a lot of people said, yes, I've had problems with 1, 2, 4, and 7, but...
The temple post?
Yeah, but I didn't know, like, I didn't know other people had those issues. Which, I think, I mean... I know that the people who go on FMH regularly feel like they can talk about it, but I think a lot of more people in the mainstream of the church don't feel like they...
Well, they may have only ever heard those sorts of criticism come from voices. And I think it's a radical shift to have it come from an embedded inside-the-church voice.
This is the value. I mean, the bullshit argument is that, you know, if we're talking about Hugh Nibley's writing or something, like, this is real Mormon discussion, and then this, you know, Feminist Mormon Housewives is just something else. But I mean, the value, when we see the temple post or other, you know, and these are discussions which have to be had. And I think you have to call people when they say, like, this is not real discussion. And Lisa and I have had this discussion a lot, because there are a lot of... very elitist, you know, intellectual snobs in a lot of people who do feel that that Feminist Mormon Housewives is not a real scholarly discussion of scholarly things which important people should be
thinking
about.
And that intimidates people like me, who I always call myself an infant feminist and an infant intellectual. I love intellectuals and I want to be intellectual, but you know, I feel like I'm always running to play catch up. And when there is that attitude, I believe it. You know, I hear as this mom who's kind of testing out the waters, and I hear that and I go, oh, yeah, I'm probably not fit to be in this kind of conversation. And I think FMH, they don't care where you're at. Here, 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 everybody's welcome.
silencing of women's voices. And then, so the Deseret News just a couple months ago republished part of Leonard Arrington's article about Mormon intellectuals. This is an article from the 70s, but the list of intellectuals who they listed were 10 men.
Yeah.
From ages ago.
In Gospel, what was it? A family class. You know, they had those classes, something about family relations. And the teacher came up to me after with a real accusatory look. He said, "You're an intellectual." And I said, What? And he said, "Well, you think." I always like that.
I heard something last week in a Redders conference about activism. And so this actually had to do with activism, environmental activism. But I think it applies. If FMH is a free speech zone, he said, we want our discussions that are not protected, and we want our discussions to happen in places that are not protected and free. So if FMH is a free zone, that's great. But going to the temple of president isn't a safe place, do you see? And it's not a free speech zone. And so that we have a responsibility to protest at the unsafe places. So in church, right? And I don't mean protest stand out. I just mean talk.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Have the discussion
there. Well, it's like, Lisa, you brought up in your Sunday school, I always think of this, like they were asking, what were the challenges of Joseph and Emma's marriage? And everyone's saying, oh, you know, he was tarred and feathered or whatever, and you...
The children died.
And I said the word polygamy.
Yeah. And that's not a safe thing to say.
What did someone say? Polygamy?
But that's how the change happens, because now you're taking that uncomfortable conversation and having it in the unsafe place. Safe here, not safe there.
And if every woman did what that one girl did, if every woman who had issues with 1, 3, and 7
mm-hmm.
went in and told the bishop,
or
the stake president, or the temple president, I have issues with 1, 3, and 7. If every woman who felt that did that, I think there would be a change.
Well, that's what Hinckley said in his interview with Mike Wallace. He said, yeah, he's like, the women are happy. They're not telling me otherwise.
Well, even more, I think, than talking to the leaders, where they can kind of, where you still are just one person, I think if we can bring that up in our Sunday school, you know, classes. Because every time we talk about the temple in Sunday school, everyone says the perfect, you know, answer, oh, it's a spiritual...
Or women telling women, I don't want the priesthood. Do you want that? I'm totally happy. We're happy. We're incredible. Did you hear? They just told us we're incredible. And it's true. I was like, yeah, they were incredible.
Told us. And so for that reason, everyone who half the class may have problems, but because everyone's saying all the right answers, they all think that they're alone, that they're a freak, they whatever. But if they could have an honest talk, you know, maybe they'd help resolve some problems, and maybe, you know, they learn, okay, a lot of people are frustrated about this.
And it's okay. It's not bad.
Yeah, yeah, they're not evil.
Just your generation.
Well, they're not evil, I am.
I had that same conversation, you know, that Lisa had. I went to church. I'm not Mormon. I've never been Mormon, but I did go to church, and in the gospel doctrine class, you know, they had the conversation about what were Emma Smith's trials, and never mentioned polygamy, and I just thought, well, they're clearly doing this on purpose. That's not my point to say, but they kept beating it over and over, like, you know, what was really happening. It's like, and they also kept referring to him as his wife, as though that was the only wife. And I love the series that Lindsay has started, talking about the other women, because it's so disrespectful to their experience to just completely wipe them off.
And can I tell you, like, I'm terrified to do it, and I keep going back and forth, and I agonize over it, because I'm like, I don't want to tear down people's faith, but I've had a few emails from people who I thought knew about all this stuff, and they're just like, I don't know what to do. That's not my intention. But it's terrifying, and then I always worry, am I going to get in trouble? Is my bishop going to call me? You know what I mean?
If you're telling the truth, that should stay on itself.
Yeah,
their reaction to the truth is not your responsibility.
Well, and it reads that way, too, that this isn't something that Lindsay woke up in the morning and, you know, was angry brushing her teeth and, like, you know, just wrote it off in kind of an angry screed. I'm not saying we don't do those, but when we do, they read that way. Like, oh, I'm so mad, da, 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 and I have a forum. But Lindsay's is a very clear, she sets the parameters very carefully, you know, in the post, you know, if this is something that, you know, like, triggers you and you don't want to, skip. There's another post for you. You know, this isn't yours. And so I think that we do everything that we can
to make it, to set the tone, to make it respectful, to make it responsible. She includes footnotes. We never include footnotes on the internet.
Well, now someone wants me to cite at Chicago, so I'm going to try that.
Really?
Well, I didn't want to. Mormons and their sources are funny, so I'm going to be.
Okay, well, our time is up. I guess I don't know what I should say to end it.
Have a brownie.
Yeah, have a great evening. Drive home safely.
Pray that no harm or accident.
Pray that no harm or accident will befall us.
Be mindful of the.
And we hope that the mint brownies nourish and strengthen your bodies.
Please obey all traffic laws.